Well, if you've just joined us today for the first time, you're very welcome. We as a church have been preaching our way through the book of Matthew, I think probably for 12 months, maybe 18 months. So we're nearly at the end. So there might be a few people happy about that. But what's worked out really nicely is that we have got to the part about the death and resurrection of Jesus just at Easter time. So that's worked out really well. And today, of course, we'll be focusing on the resurrection, which I think, of course, is the best bit. We actually, as a family, watched The Passion of the Christ last night. And it's pretty hard to watch. We fast-forwarded some bits of it. But the last bit, you know, where the light floods back into the tomb as the rock is rolled away, and you see Jesus alive again, and that drumbeat, boom, 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 comes through. You know, life can never be the same. And a new day has dawned, and life can never be the same. So what I want to do today is to look at what is the significance of the resurrection. And really, I think there's two objections that people have. Two objections that people can have to the resurrection. One is, well, did it really happen? Is this history we're talking about, or is it a myth? And then I think the second thing is this. Even if it did happen, what difference does it make? And I think this second question, in fact, is the one that people struggle with even more than the first. So we're going to start off by looking at the context. And if you've got your Bibles, open them up to Matthew chapter 28. If you've got one of the church Bibles, that's on page 706. And we're going to start reading from verse 62. And just to let you know, today we'll mainly concentrate on the resurrection account, which is chapter 28 verses 1 to 10. But we're going to look at the context, which means the verses just before and the verses just after. Because it's interesting that the resurrection account in the book of Matthew is sandwiched between two attempts to discredit the resurrection by the officials of the day. So this idea, is it true, is not really a new idea. So let's start reading from Matthew 27, verse 62. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. Then if we skip down to 28:11, immediately after our reading for today. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, 'His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep.' If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. So you remember, if you've been with us through the preaching of Matthew's gospel, Matthew is probably writing primarily to Jews. And so these are some of the alternative stories that are circulating regarding the resurrection at that time. And what's interesting is that Matthew does address them. Because what Matthew is purporting to show here is history. It's not myth. And some would say here that what we've got is the birth of Christian apologetics. In other words, arguing the reasonableness of the Christian faith. The little Sunday school boy who was asked what is faith and said, well, faith, of course, is believing something you know isn't true, was his answer. Well, sadly, I think that's the way some Christians think, that faith is believing something you know isn't true. The Bible is saying that faith is believing in something that is true. If it's not true, we shouldn't believe it. So I find it interesting in the two passages we've just read. In the first one, the chief priests call Jesus the deceiver. Did you notice that? The chief priests called Jesus the deceiver. It's in verse 63. And in the second passage, it's the same chief priests who then bribe the guards to tell a false story. So go figure. Who's the deceiver in that story? But we don't have time to look at it all today. If you're interested in this topic of apologetics and the historicity of the resurrection, there's a number of books I can highly recommend. One is Easter Enigma, which is a book I've been reading this Easter. It's written by a Christian who lived in Jerusalem in the mid-1940s, and he knew all of the locations, and he was interested to look at all of the resurrection accounts. And as he looked at them all and knew all of the locations, he could put them together. Another one is Who Moved the Stone? Now, this one was actually written by a non-Christian, or at least he was a non-Christian when he started writing the book. In fact, he had always wanted to write a book disproving the resurrection accounts. And when he finally got around to doing it, he found, in fact, that as he researched it, the evidence was so overwhelmingly positive for the resurrection that he ended up writing a very different book. And that's another good one to read, Who Moved the Stone, by Frank Morrison. A third one, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and there's a chapter on the resurrection there. But one quote will suffice for now. And I think this may have come from Evidence That Demands a Verdict, but I've heard it quoted in lots of different contexts. Lord Darling, a former Lord Chief Justice in England, asserts, in its favour, as a living truth, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true. So that's from a former Lord Chief Justice in England. Wilbur Smith says, we know more about the details of the hours immediately before and the actual death of Jesus in and near Jerusalem than we know about the death of any other one man in all the ancient world. But I guess the thing I want to concentrate on this morning is, even if it is true, what difference does it make? And this is where we'll look at chapter 28, verses 1 to 10 in more detail. So let's read verse 1, chapter 28. It says, after the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. Now, what we have to realise here is that a whole day has slipped past. The last we have heard of these two Marys is in verse 56, which is the Friday afternoon at the cross. And then we've heard of them again in verse 61, which is later again on that same day when they're at the tomb. So that was on the Friday, and now it's Sunday morning. So a whole day has slipped past. So let's have a bit more of a look at it. In verse 55 to 56 at the cross, it says, many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. So three women are specifically mentioned at the cross, and two of them are called Mary. There's another unnamed one, and she's described as the mother of Zebedee's sons. That's a funny way to describe her, isn't it? The mother of Zebedee's sons. I mean, why not just say she was Zebedee's wife? Well, because the same wording exactly is used in Matthew 20, verse 21, where this same mother asks Jesus if her two boys, named James and John, can sit at Jesus' right and left. She's just watched Jesus die between two thieves. I want you to imagine how she is feeling. She disappears from the scene and doesn't appear at the tomb. But the two Marys do. So verse 61, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. Now Mary Magdalene, we know, she's the one from whom Jesus cast out seven demons. And the other Mary is clearly in one of the other Gospels, is referred to as being married to a man called Clopas. And Clopas, or Cleopas, that's probably the same name, was one of the men who was walking on the way to Emmaus later that day. And Jesus draws up alongside them and starts talking to them. And what they say is very interesting. Jesus asks them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" Jesus asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it's now the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive." And Jesus chastises them for their lack of faith. Why am I giving you all this background? Well, because I want us to remember this is a very dark point in the story. All hope is gone. They said, we had hoped that he was the Messiah. I want you to imagine that intervening Sabbath day I was talking about. The disciples and the women who, it says, have come down from Galilee to support Jesus in his ministry. They're not just dealing with personal grief here, the loss of a friend. The whole dream has died. All this talk about the kingdom of heaven, you know, as I said, Cleopas says that he had hoped that Jesus was the Messiah. Not only that, but the disciples have completely failed Jesus. I don't know if you remember chapter 26. How many ways can you fail Jesus in one chapter? They didn't pray, remember? Jesus said, "Stay and pray with me for 1 hour." They didn't pray. They didn't watch. Jesus says, "Watch. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." They didn't watch. Peter ends up denying Jesus 3 times. Peter swears with an oath. He's never known the man. They've all run away, even though they've all said they would be faithful to death. Not just Peter. They all said, "We'll be faithful, Jesus. Don't you worry about that." The whole thing is in ruins. And thankfully, the darkest hour is usually just before dawn, isn't it? So let's keep reading. From verse 2. "There was a violent earthquake. For an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay." Now we're told in the other Gospels, those ladies went expecting to anoint a dead body that day. But Jesus says in verse 6, "He has risen just as he said." Now, in a way, they should have known that Jesus would rise again. In fact, five times through this gospel, Jesus has made it clear that he will rise again. Even twice, he said that he will not only rise again, but he will rise again on the third day. What's interesting to me is that somehow or other the chief priests seem to have remembered that more than the disciples or the women. So again, that's the fact of the resurrection. But the question is, what's the significance of all this? Are they just happy because they have been reunited with an old friend that they thought was dead? Is that what it is? Or is it simply that this gives us hope in our time when we face death? So one line of logic is this: Jesus' resurrection will comfort the disciples that when their time comes to die, that they too will be resurrected. Is that what it's about? Well, clearly that is part of it. We saw on Friday, what we call Good Friday, when Jesus died, the tombs of some of the saints were opened, and these guys came into Jerusalem after the resurrection. I mean, freak me out. Matthew chapter 27 verse 52, it says, "The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people." So it's clear that Jesus' resurrection was the first of many that were to come. It wasn't just a one-off event. And there's no doubt that the rest of the New Testament teases out this hope that we have beyond the grave. So yes, one answer is that death has been defeated. That's part of the significance of the resurrection. That's spot on. Paul says, in fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, "If there is no resurrection, we as Christians should be pitied more than all men, because we put up with suffering and hardship as Christians. If that's not true, if there is no resurrection, we should just eat, drink and be merry." So one answer to the significance of the resurrection is the defeat of death. Another is the overcoming of sin. So right at the beginning of Matthew's gospel, Matthew chapter 1, an angel comes and says, "When Jesus is born, name him Jesus, because he will save people from their sin." And not just the sin of a nation either. My sin. The disciples must have been thinking, you know, there's no way. In that intervening day, that Sabbath day, they must have been thinking, you know, there's no way that Jesus could take them back as his followers after what they'd done in chapter 26. No way. I love it in Mark's gospel when Jesus appears to the women and he says, "Go and tell the disciples and Peter. He's going ahead of you into Galilee." I love that bit, "and Peter." Make sure you tell Peter. We're getting a bit ahead of ourselves here, but in verse 10, which we'll read in a moment, Jesus doesn't just call these guys his disciples. He does that. He actually calls them his brothers. Isn't that a nice touch? "Go and tell my brothers." "Don't be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." So another answer to the significance of the resurrection is it means that Jesus has paid for my sin. And again, Paul brings this out. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 verse 17. Paul says very plainly, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile and you are still in your sins. That's clearly a significant point about the resurrection. It shows that my sins have been forgiven. But the resurrection in Matthew's gospel is something even more than that. You see, for the Jew, the resurrection was more than just about me as an individual. It's about a nation. So the classic passage that's often referred to is Ezekiel chapter 37. I'd like to read a bit of that for you so you get the flavour that for a Jew, the resurrection meant something for a group of people, a community of people, not just individuals. You'll know this passage. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord, and he set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. He asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? I said, O sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I'll put breath in you and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. I don't know how he felt prophesying to dry bones. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise. This is kind of like one of these freaky movies, isn't it? A rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked and tendons and flesh appeared on them and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. It's pretty amazing what's already happened, but there's no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. I think I would have run away by that stage. Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I'll bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, O my people, will know that I am the Lord. When I open your graves and bring you up from them, I'll put my spirit in you and you will live, and I will settle you in your own land. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken, and I have done it, declares the Lord. See, what the resurrection means in the Gospel of Matthew is that the promises regarding the kingdom of heaven are still valid. What the next verses will say as we read through is that Jesus is the Messiah. He's a different sort of Messiah to what they expected, granted. And he is still bringing in the kingdom of heaven in the timing and the way that he sees fit. Yes, the disciples had hoped for something straight away. They hoped for a rule in Jerusalem with Jesus as the head man. James and John wanted to be sitting at the right and the left in his cabinet, treasurer and prime minister, if you like. But in a way, that would have been less. If Jesus had done that, brought in a physical kingdom, that would have been less, not more, than what they had hoped for. A physical kingdom was really not a solution when it comes to sin and death. And Jesus comes offering something far better, not worse, than what they are hoping for. So let's keep reading in verses 7 to 10. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you. So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." So why have I put up a picture of a shepherd for this one? Well, because this is a continuation of chapter 26, verse 31. And I'll read it for you. In chapter 26, verse 31, Jesus says, "This very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." The shepherd is the one who will lay down his life for the sheep. The sheep don't do that. The shepherd stepped in and was the faithful one where Israel had failed. Jesus, remember, was the one who stayed awake when the disciples slept. He was the one who faithfully prayed where the disciples had not. He was the one who made the good testimony before kings and rulers, judges and priests. The disciples did not. He was our substitute. He was the one that atoned for my sins and overcame death. A shepherd does that. And now he says, "I'm going ahead of you." In other words, I'm inaugurating the kingdom. All those promises that I made are true. So the vision that Jesus has for the kingdom of heaven has two parts in a sense. There's the distant future where sin will be removed altogether. And Jesus says the Son of Man will send out his angels and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. And the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Won't that be a glorious day? Evil removed. No more pain, no more suffering. And it's not wrong to want that glorious kingdom. In fact, Matthew chapter 19, verse 28, Jesus says to his disciples, "I tell you the truth, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life." So Jesus is saying that's not a bad vision to have. The glorious kingdom in the future, it's not a bad vision to have. It's just that it's not for right now. So the second part of Jesus' vision of the kingdom is that it's also a kingdom here on earth now. And what he's saying is that that kingdom on earth here now is like the wheat that grows amongst the weeds. The two kingdoms, the evil kingdom and God's kingdom, have to coexist for a time. And what he's saying is that all power and authority has been given to him to enable that kingdom to continue to grow through the remainder of earth's history. And of course, at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, it finishes with the words, Jesus saying, "All authority on heaven and earth has been given to me." So this unfolding of this kingdom of heaven is on track, Jesus is saying. But it's not going to happen because of the disciples. It's going to happen because of Jesus. So this picture of the resurrection we meet in Matthew's gospel has a double meaning. First of all, it means that Jesus has dealt with my old enemies, sin and death, things which were too strong for me. But it also means that Jesus now lives the new life in me, in the kingdom of heaven here on earth, because otherwise I would fail at that too. I love this quote by McDowell that says, "All evidence of the New Testament goes to show that the burden of the good news or gospel was not follow this teacher and do your best, but Jesus and the resurrection. It's his life being lived in me." And yet what he's saying at the moment is he's now going to go to Galilee. Not Jerusalem, not the place of glory and prestige, but Galilee, to mix with the meek and the lowly, to continue the mission on. Galilee of the Gentiles. Remember, Jesus was called a Nazarene, which means someone who is despised. And if we're to work with him, we will be despised in this life. The glory will come in the future. Our mission at the moment is in the humble places of the earth with Jesus. The wheat and the weeds have to coexist for a time. So this picture of the death and resurrection of Jesus in the Bible becomes a metaphor for the entire Christian walk. Jesus, our shepherd, deals with our enemies of death and the old life. We're not strong enough to do that. Deals with sin and death. But Jesus, our shepherd, also lives now the new life in us. And we're not strong enough to do that either. So I want to finish up with this thought. We've been looking at the passion of Jesus under the theme of the greatest story ever told. What I want to suggest to you is this. This is not a great story simply because it's all about something fantastic that Jesus did 2,000 years ago. And we kind of sit back and say, wow, wasn't that fantastic? And we all start clapping Jesus. It's the greatest story ever told because it involves us. We're going to share communion in a moment where we incorporate that into our lives. The victories that Jesus has won over our enemies, our old life. The victory that he provides for us in living the new life. We participate in that. It's not just a story of 2,000 years ago. It's not even just a true story of 2,000 years ago. It impacts us here and now. So I'd invite John to come forward again, and we're just going to finish off today with communion.